connection is about relationships. You know, relationships are sort of the beating heart of what it means to be a human being, you know, the Harvard study, all of those things, right? So when we are in relation to other people and we're connected to them, you know, doing something doesn't feel like a chore necessarily. If we like and respect that other person, we're doing it gladly because we're doing it in partnership with them and, you know, together with them, or it's going to serve them or what have you.
If you're a high achiever who wants your ambition to extend beyond your professional goals and into your well-being and relationships, you're in the right place. I'm Valerie Martin, a certified high-performance coach and therapist of 12 years, and I'm obsessed with teaching and coaching folks how to cultivate compassionate self-discipline. We all have a spark alive within us, no matter how small or dim it might feel right now. And it is our greatest purpose and our greatest responsibility to honor it. Because when we do, we become better partners, leaders, parents, creators, and family members in the interconnected web of this wild, dark, miraculous, beautiful world. Tune in every other week for a new interview or solo episode and connect with me on Instagram at HonorYourSpark. Let's jump into the episode. Hey y'all, welcome back to Honor Your Spark. Let's jump right into what I've been watching, reading, and loving recently, and then I will tell you about today's guest. So I started watching, I feel like this like needs to come with a disclaimer, but I'm like, yes, I'm about to be 38, and I just started watching Gossip Girl for the first time. I don't know why. I just, one of my feel-good shows is Sex and the City, and I've just like watched it too many times now. And honestly, I'm enjoying this way more than I have the right to. So it's six seasons. We'll see if I make it through all six. I am reading Deep Work, rereading, because I'm just on a Cal Newport kick right now. I mean, I'm always engaging with like his podcast and can't wait for the book Slow Productivity to come out soon. And yeah, I needed a Deep Work like dose of medicine, and I'm exploring some possible ways that as I approach my birthday, as I'm recording this, it's next week. By the time this comes out, it'll be a bit after. But I really want to go into my next year with some more depth, and that might look like, I don't know, like a 100-day experiment of depth. So stay tuned on that. And recently I'm loving Velvet Caviar, which is a brand that makes cases and also watch straps. So if you're watching this on video, you will see this lovely watch strap that I love for my Apple Watch. Also, my computer that is currently housing where I'm recording has a gorgeous case, and also my AirPods case. So those are the three things that I got, and I love all of them, especially the laptop case. And they do have stuff for non-iPhone devices too. So not an ad, just something that I haven't shared here yet that I wanted to plug. Okay, our guest today is Jason Shen, who is an executive coach for Outlier Talent and the author of The Path to Pivot, a playbook for founders looking to reboot their business. Jason led product teams at companies like Meta and Etsy and founded three venture-backed companies. A first-generation immigrant, Jason earned 2 degrees in biology from Stanford, where he won an NCAA championship in men's gymnastics. Just like a real underachiever, you guys. His writing has appeared in Every, Vox, Fast Company, and TechCrunch. After nearly a decade in Silicon Valley, Jason decamped to Brooklyn, where he lives with his wife, Amanda, a fierce multidisciplinary artist. Jason is just a really cool guy. Really enjoyed this conversation with him. So you can find links in the show notes, and you can find him over on the web at jasonshen.com, on LinkedIn, and pathtopivot.com as well. Lastly, this episode is sponsored by my own private podcast, You Are Motherfucking Enough. It is a 4-part series that will teach you to shift from patterns of self-doubt and criticism to owning your enoughness. I created this private podcast series because I see how often shame, self-doubt, and constant self-criticism holds people back from fully stepping into their purpose, passion, and aliveness. So I give so many strategies and skills and my own personal experiences. I have distilled 12 years of being a therapist and a coach into 60 minutes of really, really polished audio content here for you. Get this private podcast series over at honoryourspark.com/enough. And the link for that will be in the show notes for this episode as well. All right, let's jump into the conversation with Jason Shen. Jason, I'm so excited for this conversation. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Valerie. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So I always am starting with this question related to the topic of the show or the name of the show, which is, what is something that you wish a past therapist, coach, mentor would have told you?
Yeah, I would have wished somebody had told me to build the business, do the project, do the thing you originally wanted, not the thing you think you need to do in order to do the thing you wanted. I am now an executive coach, but I started multiple startups because in part of my mind, I was like, I need to build these other businesses and be legitimate in these other ways before I can go and start coaching. And, you know, I don't think that it was a waste of time, but I certainly don't think I needed to sort of stress over these entrepreneurial journeys so hard if my real desire and goal was ultimately to coach and help people in the ways that I do now.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about a session I had with a client this week who worked, I mean, Nashville's a big music industry city. And so she grew up, you know, wanting to be an artist, but like, oh, you know, go to college, get a real job, and then like, maybe play some gigs and see what happens, right? Do the responsible thing. So she worked in the industry for a really large booking firm and got burnout, hated it, and is now like, you know, mid-20s, like reinvent and wanting to commit to being an artist. And like this, like said it exactly that kind of thing of like, I kind of knew all along, like I've felt since I was a little kid, this thing in me, like that is what I'm meant to do. But I thought, well, no, you can't really do that. So just get close to it, you know, work in the industry. And right. Yeah, it's just so true.
Rick Rubin talks about, I don't know if it's Rick or somebody else, talks about this idea of shadow careers, where you don't do the artist thing, but you like, yeah, you book artists or you work at a museum or you do something that's like adjacent to the real thing you want because that's too scary, but then you're like close to it.
Yes, absolutely. And of course there are people who are in those adjacent roles who that is their thing, right? They love it. They don't want to be doing the thing. They want to support it. But I think a lot of us resonate with that idea of kind of like not really going for the thing we want. So get close enough. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what a great thing to start with. And before we go on to more relevant content, I just need to know about this BB-8. So okay. Those of you not watching on video, I asked Jason before recording, he's got some bookshelves behind him and then this like BB-8, I would say, I don't know, life size, whatever size BB-8 yeah, would be he's, in
let's,
real
let's
life.
Let's bring him over.
Yeah, yeah. like up to like knee height, practically BB-8 figurine. That looks like, you know, you could just turn him on and he would start doing stuff. And your answer, what you said, I was like, now I need the whole story.
This is a good intro because it kind of tells you a lot about me. When I was dating my now wife and we were just, you know, sort of together, the new Star Wars movies were coming out and they were doing a ton of promo for all, you know, all these like movie tie-ins. And there was a tie-in with HP and HP, you know, computing company, and there's like a boy who builds an R2-D2 in his garage and uses it to drive to this girl's house and gives him a note that's like, will you go to prom with me? And he's like watching through the camera and she's like, yes. And I'm like, this is a bad ad because it's teaching young men, boys, that they shouldn't interact with them and they shouldn't talk to, it's too scary to talk to them face to face, that they should build a robot and use the robot to communicate. That's never going to work in real life. You know, like you are, that goes down. Oh, gross. Quickly. Get away from me. Right. what are you doing? Stop. Get off my property. And my wife said, you know what? If someone built a robot just for me to communicate with me, I'd be impressed. I'd give him a chance. And I was like, okay. File that one away. And so my wife is an artist, and we can talk more about that and sort of her career as an artist. But you know, one of the things is she appreciates more than like fancy, you know, date nights or expensive like gifts is she always wants me to make something for her. So she also doesn't like surprises. So she knew the day that I was going to propose to her, right? So, but she didn't know what I was going to do. And so what I ended up doing is building a chatbot that you texted, and it was a scavenger hunt. So I went with her on the scavenger hunt, but she was getting the clues from this bot that she had to go to this location, find some piece of information, submit it, and then that would give her the next clue. And we kind of like went from place to place throughout New York, which is where we met, and you know, places where we worked, our first date, you know, various things in the city. And then finally we ended up in Central Park, in this part of the park that's further up north, and I can't remember the name of the area right now, but it's like more secluded. And arranging with her friend, she got a BB-8 to kind of plant it. And I bought this BB-8 and I planted it in sort of like where we were going to walk. And I told her to look in this little pocket that he has in this device, and had a little folded note that said, like, will you marry me? Yes, no. Right. So ultimately I built my own, you know, digital bot and physical robot to ask my wife to marry me, and she said yes. So that was a lovely, lovely way to
Oh,
kind of propose.
that's amazing. I love it. And I have to share because the timing of this is too funny. Earlier today, I was reading another book in preparation for a podcast interview, and she talks about like having your goblin-y friends that you might like. You might get a lizard pet or a spider pet or hermit crabs. And it took me back to my senior year of high school. My boyfriend at the time asked me to prom using hermit crabs. He
Oh.
your face. He went to like the kiosk in the mall that sells hermit crabs. Why? I don't know if that's still a thing. And then got three of them and like designed their shells to say, "How about prom?" I was thinking, surely it wasn't, "Will you go to prom with me?" That would be like seven.
Too
So I think it
many,
was,
too
"How about
many.
prom?" But yeah, I was just thinking about those poor crabs this morning because as she was talking about the care for them, I was like, I don't think I did all that. These poor crabs, I don't think they made it
We're
very far.
suffering. Yeah, now you have to keep the crabs. How long did
Know.
those crabs live?
I really don't remember. Like now I want to call my mom and be like, "Mom, do you remember? Did you help with these crabs?" So
Right.
funny. Oh my
Oh,
gosh.
that's funny. That
Okay.
is funny.
So pivoting back to our topic
Okay.
for today. But thank you for indulging. That was really a really fun way to start. So you have written a book that I guess you're still iterating and
Yeah,
working.
we're getting
Do you
close
have the
now. Like
okay?
I'll pull out, you know, and see.
Yeah, nice.
It's
Hard
in here, you
copy.
know. Yeah,
Cool.
but we're gonna get it one more round of revisions and then it'll be good to go. Yeah.
Awesome. So Path to Pivot, and in this book, you're talking specifically to startup founders. So as someone who's outside of that world, I mean, I'm a founder, I guess. I run a team of about 15, but I don't
Yeah.
consider it myself a founder. It's a therapy practice. But anyway, so I felt like I was getting a lot of interesting look into that world, like the real world complement to my Silicon Valley HBO education, right? And of course, a lot of the lessons apply outside of, I think,
Yes, that's
the
true.
startup world too. But I'm curious what made you want to write this specific book, and also what helped you feel comfortable to niche down to just startup founders?
Oh, such good questions. Because the truth is, I love books. You can see behind me. I love books. I was a huge reader growing up. I still read a lot now, probably too much on like small things on my phone and not enough physical. But it's not for love of, not for not having love of physical books. Just, it's hard. You know,
Convenience,
you don't
yeah.
always have them on you. So I always wanted to write a book, and I actually did. I've done various book proposals and been in touch with an agent from like a publishing house to do like a formal book for a number of years. And I actually put together a pretty extensive, you know, 50-page proposal with the sample chapters and marketing plan, everything for this book around resilience. And I developed a framework around resilience, four skills, all these things. And she finally read it, all of it, and said, "It, this is really thoughtful and this is well researched, but like you don't have some special reason to be the resilience guy, you know, and there's no special angle for you, and you don't have like a million followers on, you know, LinkedIn to just like sell it. So sorry, we're gonna have to pass. And I was like pretty devastated. That was like, you know, a year of my life really trying to invest in this and be like, this is gonna be the one, I'm gonna do it. And so eventually I started writing about pivots almost like as a throwaway kind of thing. It was just like, hey, you know, I did Ship 30 for 30, which is like a program that tries to get you to tweet every day back when Twitter was still kind of like platform du jour of tech people. It's kind of gotten a little weird now. And I post a lot about pivots. I've been a three-time founder and I had a pivot that failed. I had a pivot that was more successful. And so I was like, this is something I know about and I haven't written a lot about. So let me just try to do that. And as I did that, I was finding like a lot of energy and interest in it. And I realized that there wasn't a lot of like comprehensive, authoritative information about it. There's like people telling their own pivot stories, cutting out a lot of parts of the story. There's like some kind of ad hoc advice that various people have had, but I don't think anyone's really investigated this thoroughly. And so I kind of was like, well, one of my mottos is make new mistakes. So if my previous mistake was, this is too generic, this is too broad, who is this for? Why are you the right person? I was like, well, this is very specific. This is going to be about only venture-backed startup founders and specifically about this pivot thing based on my own personal experience going through this twice and doing a bunch of research on like various companies that have done this. And that was the reason why. And I see this as the starter book, right? Like I'm going to do this book and then I'm going to do other books. I'm going to write about a lot of other topics, but let's start with something that I know really well, that there isn't a lot out there. Maybe the market for this book isn't very large, but at least I will be the go-to book in this area because there's not going to be anything else that is like that people have attempted to put even as much thought into it as I have.
Yeah, that's so, so true. And the other cool thing is, like you said, I mean, even if it's not that large, the people who find it, like, I mean, gosh, again, my Silicon Valley education, I'm like, if Richard had found this book, it would have saved his life, right? No panic attacks.
Yeah.
And people who are going to find it are going to be so grateful for it.
And, you know, I'm influenced by this person named Rob Fitzpatrick, who wrote the book called The Mom Test. And he self-published it. And it's about like four technical founders who don't want to sell, but kind of need to figure out what their product needs to be. And over the years, it's really grown. And his take is that it's really important to be narrow about your book concept. And this is a little meta, but hopefully interesting for the listeners, is if you're really narrow about your book, then you're not going to get bad reviews from people who this book isn't really for. If I wrote a book about resilience and then someone's like, well, I had this terrible divorce and I thought this book was going to help me, but it's not really about that. And like, I didn't have any tips for me. It's like, okay, well, you know, that's difficult. But if anyone who reads this, you know, someone's not going to be like, it's not like path to pivot anything in your life, your career, your business, any pivot, you know, and then it's like, well, I had a job change and I'm, you know, retiring and I had to pivot and this isn't, you know, it's upfront. It's like, hey, this is for this type of person. And that doesn't mean you can't read it and get value out of it, but it's like you're going to read it from that lens. And the same is true for like the inner game of tennis, right? The inner game of tennis is like literally about a guy trying to teach tennis and the sort of meta skills of tennis that he's realized, which is like sometimes not instructing is better than being super detailed about the instruction. Mm-hmm. And now it's like heralded as this book about the mental game of anything. And and like people read it out of that context, but we understand that he was a tennis coach writing about tennis. And we have to take our own steps to extrapolate from that to other things. So anyway, so you sort of write it for the audience and therefore it can get kind of like high marks and then it could still expand, but you started with a much tighter promise that you can fulfill.
This episode is brought to you by a private podcast from yours truly called You Are Motherfucking Enough. It's a four-part series that will teach you how to shift from patterns of self-doubt and criticism to owning your enoughness. I created You Are Motherfucking Enough because I'm tired of seeing how often self-doubt, shame, and constant criticism hold people back from stepping fully into their purpose, passion, and aliveness. And I believe that it takes a lot more than just an empathetic listener, whether that's a therapist, coach, or friend, to actually learn and apply the strategies that will allow you to make that positive shift long term. I'm not kidding, y'all. The value of these episodes is worth the cost of multiple therapy or coaching sessions. And you can get instant access to this series for $0. I've condensed 12 years of experience working with these issues into 60 minutes of content. You don't want to miss this one. Get instant free access to listen almost anywhere you get your podcasts by signing up at honoryourspark.com/enough. That link will also be in the show notes for the episode that you're currently listening to. All right, let's get back to the show. And so your passion is really in the resilience work, right? It's obviously something you talk a lot about, even in this current book already. I mean, that was like kind of the start.
I was able to work it in kind of in the last chapter.
Yeah. And even in the very beginning where you talk about your first startup and we didn't run out of money, we ran out of resilience. So I would love to hear how, because resilience is one of those things. It's like it's ineffable. Like we kind of know it, but we don't. Like, how do we define it? How do we actually do it? So maybe starting with, how do people even know that resilience is something they need more of?
Well, there are many definitions of resilience, right? But the one that I go with is like the capacity to adapt in the face of adversity and change. Now, all you have to do is ask yourself, do you think in the future you will face more adversity and change than you did in the past? And, you know, I think we've all had this sort of, or sort of coming on the other side of this like crazy life, world-shaping pandemic. But one of the truths of anything is that if it can happen once, it can happen again, you know, knock on the wood, but like crazy things happen a lot more often than we think and we like to believe. And we're really interconnected now. So something that affects one part of the world, you know, has spillover effects. And so you don't really see it coming. And then all of a sudden, here it is, right? 200, 300, 500 years ago, like day-to-day life was pretty routine. And yeah, you had a freak weather occurrence, or you had a sort of, you know, changing of the king is slain and a new king from a different area is coming in. But for the most part, day-to-day life is kind of the same. But like our lives have really ramped up in how much, you know, is going on at any given time. So that's my argument for why I think resilience is a capacity we all need to continue to cultivate more of.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good answer. Anyone, if you're alive, you probably could use more of this. And what would you say to someone who's, I know, again, you could write an entire book, multiple books just on this topic, but who's eager to cultivate more resilience, but doesn't really know where to start?
Right. So I think what I like to say is that resilience is a bundle of skills. It's a collection of skills. And I have four that I think are pretty helpful to think about. One is respond, which is sort of like right after something is happening, can you kind of like pull it together and get, you know, the flight's delayed or, and you're going to miss your big meeting. Like, you know, we all know that person who would have been like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go here. We're going to rent a car. We're going to drive. We're going to call them. We're going to like reschedule. We're going to find a thing, get on the phone with so-and-so and kind of like get through the initial hurdle of the danger of the situation. Right. Then there's restore, which is about like, oh, we missed the meeting or this happened. And, you know, you sort of, how do you heal from that? How do you like connect to your community and get the resources that you need more broadly? Hey, like this, you know, town has been hit by a hurricane. We need resources and like can go out and get people and support an allyship. That's a second skill. Third skill is rebuild, which is like having creativity and a vision to do something new. You know what? This business isn't working out, but guess what? You can go and do something else with your life now. What do you want it to be? And having that open-endedness, being able to kind of let go of the past and being able to like envision new possibilities, that's its own skill. And the final skill, reflect, is about learning. It's about sort of, you know, processing and thinking about how you're going to change the way you do something. So it's like, okay, we had the site go down. What are we going to implement into our checklist so that, you know, we prevent those kinds of things from happening in the future? And also, how do you talk about it, right? And I'm sure that's just something you see in your practice. Like, if you can't really talk about it, you haven't really gotten over it. And it's not that you have to go and put your sob story or your difficult experience to everybody and your every neighbor and whoever, but like if you can't speak about it in a safe environment with someone who you trust, you haven't fully gotten through that experience, in my perspective. And so looking at those four skills, I think most of us could take a little assessment, and I have a little quiz that I could probably send that has like a version of this, where you can kind of see you're probably strong in certain areas and like, not so strong in other areas. And so that can be a place to start to think about like, okay, well, what can I do to raise that part of my resilience skill level? Right. Yeah. And how can I, sometimes you over lean on something and that creates problems. And so like, how can I be aware of when I'm over leaning on the firefighting all the time, but never recovering, or the always doing the new thing, but never thinking about what you should change from the last time you did it. Those are the patterns that we can start to address.
Yes. Yeah. Sounds very familiar. but I love that. I love thinking of it as a collection of skills, because it is kind of overwhelming to think like, okay, just become more resilient now. But it really is right. Like when we break it down smaller, we absolutely can be cultivating and sort of training ourselves in these sub skills. So I'm already looking forward to that next book. But before we move on from pivot, you've of course made some big pivots in your own life, from founding, co-founding multiple startups, working at Meta, and then leaving Meta to focus on your coaching business. What are you most excited about with your more recent pivot into coaching?
Yeah. I mean, I want to learn from you and everything that you're doing with your practice. Obviously therapy and coaching are different, but there's a lot of similarities in the service
I'm doing both, yeah.
nature of it. Yeah, you do both. For me, what's so interesting about coaching and this business that I'm building now is that it's like my forever business, and I think that's my dream, that's my hope for it, is that when you date and you date people and you're kind of like, oh, this is fun for a while and it had its time and now it's over. And that's how I feel about my startups. Like I love doing them, but also like even when a startup is super successful, it transforms into this totally different thing. And then you either are running a huge company or a huge company buys your thing or you're public, it's just not the same, right? And do you still want to do that? It's just not. Whereas there was a part of me when I was doing my startups that I never felt like I put 100% in, because I felt that there was a risk that it might shut down. And, then you got to like save a little bit of yourself and for what's going to happen after that. Whereas this feels like the work I do this year is going to help me next year. And it's going to help me in 3 years, and the work I do in 2 years will help me in 5 years. And so I just feel like I'm getting the full compounding interest of all my investments in the content that I create, the people that I meet. And look, in 5 years, you might call me up and I'm like, I'm fixing up airplanes, and doing something completely different. But that's how I feel right now. And that's exciting, because I haven't felt that in the past.
Oh, that's so cool. And I resonate so much with it, but I was just like, such a powerful metaphor, because I feel the same about my sort of coaching business. Like the therapy practice is great and I love it for its own reasons, but like this is my playground and this is me being my most like authentic self and all of that. And so it feels like it could be the forever business, but unlike when you're you're looking for your forever home, and there's a difference between you go and you tour the one where you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. I love everything about it. We don't need to do any work on this place. We can just move right in, bring our stuff, right? There's that forever home. And then there's the like plot of land where it's like, okay, we're going to build the forever home here, but it's going to take like 4 years. That's what I feel like I'm doing with this business.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think about the sort of this distinction? You sort of talk about the practice and you have, folks who are on staff with you. How do you separate that? What is the distinction in your mind?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting in the like therapy, mental health industry, because part of it is our licensing boards don't know what the hell to do with this coaching thing, right? And yet arguably we're more equipped than your like average life coach on the street to be supporting people. But it's because they're just, you know, caution over everything. They don't, whatever. So therapists who are sort of braving that new world of coaching, they're like, okay, separate businesses, separate bank accounts, you know, two LLCs, two websites, two completely separate businesses. Mm. So it kind of started that way. But then as my team expanded and I shifted in 2020 from solo practice to slowly building my team, the Gaia Center is a thing that is much different and larger than just me, right? So mm-hmm. I almost have to protect, like, that is its own entity and I love it and it's great, but it's not all me. And so this, like, bad bitch therapist kind of stuff is like, that's where I just get to be fully me and do whatever the hell I want, right? And coach and teach and like break any rules that I want, because I'm not doing this within the bounds of my state limited licensure. So it's separate for those reasons, and yet it gets really confusing because of course there's a lot of overlap and, you know, expenses. I'm like, I don't know. Well, I'll put it on this card. I don't know. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I see that. And I know several founder coaches who have that psychology and, you know, therapy background before they started kind of doing coaching. And it's even interesting because there are like licensed coaches and there's like that dynamic where, you know, it's almost like therapy, like from a different angle where they don't give advice or they don't like make judgment statements. They only sort of ask questions or try to guide the client. Right. Well, you know, that's one of the things I throw out there is like the benefits and the difference. And I see clients who have therapists too, right? And it's, and they serve separate purposes. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I see therapy being really powerful to support coaching because like what I notice is the clients that I have, and I'm sure you've seen this, who also have a therapy practice, they're more able to handle uncomfortable feelings, sort of resolve, like talk through, like, I know that it doesn't feel like this is going to happen right now, but that's because of the, you know, they can kind of like coach themselves through some of their emotional things. And then we can focus on the bigger picture versus sometimes you see that somebody's blocked by something, but you also like, you're like, well, we're not going to get through that in this session or even next week. And like, there's more help that you could get to support that. And I'm not always equipped to support that, but like, it's like the dough has been kneaded so you can like make better bread. I don't know.
That's a great metaphor because it's so true. Like, we know that the mindset stuff, and I mean, that's a large umbrella term, but obviously it's relevant to what someone might be wanting to do via coaching, like in their career, in their life. And yet if the dough's not been kneaded yet, like, you're not going to be able to get very far in that coaching work. So yeah, I think that's great. And one more coaching related question for you before we move on to the next thing is, I know you use the kind of the phrase executive coaching. And as someone who's never been in the corporate world, I'm like, I think I know what that means, but explain it to me like I'm 10.
Executive coaching. So I really, you know, the term, there's so many like blank coach, right? Life coach, mindset coach, confidence coach. You know, I've been trying this term outlier coach, which is more like a, you know, kind of like your bad bitch therapist, like a moniker of sorts. But executive coaching is the sort of, you know, generic statement I would offer for what I do. And that's because I think it's positioned for two reasons. One, it's to attract the right type of client, right? Which is to say people who are in leadership positions and, you know, and that can be as an entrepreneur or that can be as a, you know, corporate executive, which I find more similarities than differences at the highest realms. I don't coach like middle managers and things like that because there's a lot more like politicking and sort of like corporate dynamics at play. But at the highest levels, they're more similar because there's both a lot of autonomy and a lot of pressure and a lot of responsibility. So they kind of share that. But it's to say that I'm bringing both my experience as a business operator and looking at their activities as a business leader. And we're going to also support them as a human being. It just so happens that most executives, their career and their business work is a huge part of who they are and what they're about, right? So we're going to, you know, we're going to focus like maybe 70% of our time, if not more, on that part of themselves. We're also going to talk about like, hey, your health, how's it going? Family, what's going on there? Like, are you sleeping okay? Do you need to change routine personally? Because the personal affects the business and the business affects the personal. So that's sort of why I put it that way.
Okay, that makes sense. And you mentioned outlier coaching. Tell us what it means to be an outlier.
Well, the phrase outlier comes from, you know, science and math. And it's this idea of like, you have a lot of data and you have like a trend line and sort of like everything's kind of clustered in a normal distribution or normal fashion. And then there's like a dot way up in the corner somewhere. And like, what's going on with that? And sometimes we delete the outliers because we're like, oh, that's just like a mess up. You know, the instrument was wrong or whatever. That's just like a one-off. But the truth is, often deleting outliers cleans up the data, but there's a lot to be learned from the outlier. And sometimes the outlier is not a mess up. It's real. It really is that good on some dimensions and probably really problematic or you know, off in some other dimensions. And that's what's interesting to me. I certainly relate to that in myself as an immigrant, as an ADHD individual. And my wife, who I mentioned, is an artist who has this tremendous vision for the kind of work that she can do, but also, you know, has her own upbringing challenges and sort of background that affects her ability to move through the world. So an outlier is someone who has remarkable abilities, unconventional backgrounds, and doesn't sort of fit in relative to a peer set. They sort of stand out in good and bad ways. And that's, I think, indicative of founders, of many executives, and of the other individuals that I coach.
Yes, and many neurodivergent humans. Yes. Yeah, you're speaking my language. I kind of say that I'm talking to my fellow misfits out there. And it's like, especially, you know, people who are just have always been drawn to like ambition. And yet, how do we do that in a way that doesn't kill ourselves in the process?
Yes, there's a lot of burnout that can occur because not only are you trying to, you know, do all these things right and use your talents and skills, but you're trying to like figure out why you can't do these basic things that everyone else seems to do. And how can you contort yourself to like look like everybody? Oh, they're all doing it. I'm going to try to do this too. And even though it feels really weird and uncomfortable for me.
Yeah. Okay, we're killing it with the segues today because the next thing I wanted to ask about is you recently wrote about anti-discipline. And I think like the way that you described discipline in that post, like the sort of harsh thing that a lot of us think of, right? The connotation we have with that word, I think most of us, I would agree, are allergic to that. And yet, you know, then there's the Gogginses of the world who are like, I don't know, maybe... I heard an interesting take on it recently, and I can't remember where, but basically the person was like, you know, it's like the 19-year-old dudes who are like, all they're doing all day is playing video games. They're the ones who need that message, but we get that message into the wrong hands, and it's can be very damaging. So anyway, I talk a lot about developing compassionate self-discipline, but I want to hear about what you mean by anti-discipline and the three C's of challenge, connection, and curiosity.
Yeah, I love this. And look, I have a competitive athletics background. I was a gymnast. And so there's a part of me that, you know, hears when David Goggins is talking about what he's doing. And I'm like,
totally.
Yeah, I'm like right there with him. You know, I'm kind of like psyched. I'm like, where's the gym? I need to get in there. But the term discipline, as I described, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's really about, you know, enforcing behavior against a set of rules and restricting disobedience through threat of punishment, right? Yikes, so we're talking about like, yeah, it's pretty dark, you know, obedience, disobedience from, you know, a really rigid set of activities, and punishment is sort of the mechanism to enforce that obedience. That is, and that's why we say we discipline somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're disciplining our child, and you know, that's punishing them. That's really what we mean. It's like, you know, and so people will often say, oh, you must be really disciplined because you work out so often. And I don't feel that it's coming from that place. And I know that they're not necessarily meaning it in that way, but yeah, the words matter, right? And so like being aware of what the words mean, I took the term anti-discipline in kind of like the way Nassim Taleb talked about anti-fragility, mm-hmm. right? Sort of like, what is the opposite of discipline, but still in the direction, which is to say, how do I get myself to do things? Because I'm not going to be using self-punishment to get there. So the three C's are sort of what I realized were how I do get there: connection, challenge, and creativity or curiosity, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, what am I going to learn from this, right? Like we have a natural pull to questions, right? And that's why like great content always starts with like a interesting question or premise that we're like, oh, I need to know more. So you're drawn to that, right? Connection is about relationships. You know, relationships are sort of the beating heart of what it means to be a human being, you know, the Harvard study, all of those things, right? So when we are in relation to other people and we're connected to them, you know, doing something doesn't feel like a chore necessarily. If we like and respect that other person, we're doing it gladly because we're doing it in partnership with them and, you know, together with them, or it's going to serve them or what have you. And then the last one is challenge. Challenge is probably the closest one where it gets into like some of this Goggins stuff of like this really hard thing. But the question is really like, can I do it? You know, like, and will I be proud of myself if I do it? Not that I will be ashamed of myself if I don't do it, mm-hmm. right? Like I've gone and set, you know, world records through, you know, through fitness or the Guinness World Records. But I always did it because I was like, this would be really, I'd be really proud of myself. I think this would be really cool and it will be hard, but I want to get through it. Like, you know, and people do things because they are afraid of the shame and the, and you know, they need to fill a hole in their heart. And I think a lot of really on paper successful leaders are driven by those sort of maybe negative emotions or discipline, as it were. But I don't personally connect to that, and I don't think that's necessarily healthy. Lots of things people do aren't healthy, and you know, we can choose whether or not to engage in that. But that's what it works. Well, that's what works for me, anti-discipline.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, it reminds me of kind of the idea of, you know, are we doing it more for approach or avoid? Am I approaching this because I like where this could take me, versus I'm avoiding having to feel what I would feel if I don't do it, what I would think about myself. Yeah, I'm gonna have to do some more digging around the word discipline. Like I said, I think there's a way we can angle it to where we can approach self-discipline, you know, as a noun, not the discipline verb, mm-hmm. but approach that in a more compassionate and sustainable way. But it, you know, that's not historically how it's been done. Of course, I'm really into Ryan Holiday's Discipline is Destiny. But I love this idea. So I look forward to hearing more of your thoughts in the future on that. And is there anything else just from your time as a competitive gymnast that either still serves you today or that you've had to let go of because it no longer serves you?
You know, what gymnastics really taught me was that our, you know, brains and our bodies are capable of doing far more than you can imagine. Because you go into a gymnastics facility and, you know, you're learning how to do a forward roll, a cartwheel, some really, really basic stuff. You're like, oh, there's some equipment. You don't even know how to like get on there. And then you have people swinging around doing flips and tricks all around that piece of equipment. And it's just like beyond your imagination, right? Like, you know, when you see little kids playing soccer or you see middle schoolers playing soccer and you see, you know, the professionals, I'm not saying that they're not a million times better than the middle schoolers, but the activities that they're performing feel similar. And, you know, I'm mm-hmm. going to get some hate from some football players.
Running after and kicking.
This. But you're running, you're kicking. There's a lot of subtleties and nuances there. But like yeah. you can imagine yourself doing yeah. those things, right? And then you go to a gymnastic facility and you're just like, someone's on the balance beam, someone's on the pommel. Just like, people can't even like visualize in their mind what it would be like to do this thing because it's so, and yet, you know, through training, through coaching, through years of effort and some might say discipline, you can get there, right? And so that doesn't mean everyone can get to the Olympics. You know, there's a limited number of slots for that. And there's certain moves that I wanted to learn and I never fully got to be able to do, but I certainly got way farther than that, 6-year-old self or even the 12-year-old version of myself could imagine. And I like to take that big potential perspective to the things that I do and to my clients, and that knowing that they have, so much of this supportive mindset, the work that we do is not putting limits on what our clients can do. You know, it's very natural for people to be like, yeah, they don't got it, and I think part of my job is to be like, they totally could got it. I'm not going to say that. I'll never say that, mm-hmm. right? For somebody else. But yeah, that's one important lesson.
I love it. Cool. Well, I could keep talking to you for a while, but I know we're kind of wrapping up our time. So Of course it'll be in the show notes, but tell the people where they can find you and anything you're up to.
Yeah, I, focus a lot of my content on LinkedIn these days. As I was mentioning, I think, Twitter X has had its time, and I'm bringing a lot of my thoughts on outliers, on pivots there. And it's just, Jason Shen, one word. My website, jasonshen.com, as well as my site about the path to pivot, pathtopivot.com. So those are sort of three places where they can learn more.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was such a great conversation.
Valerie, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Yes, friend, you made it to the end of the episode. I so appreciate you tuning in. And if you enjoyed this episode, make my day by subscribing and leaving a 5-star rating to help other people find this podcast. I'd love for you to connect with me on Instagram at HonorYourSpark. And don't forget to sign up for my 4-episode private podcast series all about kicking self-criticism to the curb at honoryourspark.com/enough. See you in the next episode.